Thanks for joining us at the Business Growth Cafe, where each week we select from a menu of topics for a focused discussion with an industry expert to provide insights that can impact your business's growth. With your host, Angelo Ponzi.
I am Angelo Ponzi, your host here at the Business Growth Cafe, and thank you for joining us. Each week, we select from a menu of topics that can impact business growth to discuss with experts on a wide variety of disciplines. And today at the cafe, I'm excited to have Mike Carroll, Managing Partner at CorpGen Counsel, on our show to discuss the anatomy of selling or buying a business, as well as the importance of corporate governance, or lack thereof, that can impact your business. Mike, welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Angela. It's great to be here.
Yeah, I'm happy to have you here. I think it's going to be a great discussion. Before we get started, why don't you take a few minutes and tell the audience a little about yourself and your company?
Sure, absolutely. So the practice is CorpGen Counsel. It's sort of a hybrid organization. It's organized like a law firm, so we practice corporate securities law, mergers and acquisitions, and a fair amount of private equity and fund work for high net worth individuals, private companies ranging from smaller sizes to mid-size to larger size privately owned, family-owned companies, as well as smaller publicly traded companies, generally traded on the small over-the-counter on NASDAQ. And what we do is we provide general counsel services for these businesses, where companies that don't have a general counsel in-house as an employee, what we do is we sort of work there either in an on-site or off-site capacity, providing these legal services on an outsourced basis.
Okay. Well, sounds a little bit like what I do as fractional chief marketing officer. And so you're kind of like a fractional chief counsel.
Fractional general counsel. But we're still like you. We're very much, you know, we are the general counsel.
Right.
We're the attorney, just like you're the marketing officer. And we take that stuff very seriously. So the neat thing about it is, while we are not an employee of the companies and the clients that we work for, we're truly embedded within the organization.
Well, and I think you have to be, especially in the roles that we take on. I mean, it isn't about just popping in and, you know, doing something real quick and leaving. And we get immersed in their business and really so we can offer the counsel that they really need.
Yeah, you really have to. And it's funny, members on my team that work in the organization, we literally limit ourselves to a few clients, because after that point, you really can't embed yourself. You really can't truly be there general counsel and know the ins and outs of their businesses, the peoples, the ups, the downs, the wants, the desires, and the places that you want to get your clients to.
Right. Well, we're subject to time, right?
True.
We have time to sell, and you know, if you want to carve off a little niche for yourself, we had a show not too long ago about employee health and wealth and balance, life balance, and so we all try to achieve that. So we're subject to time. So let's get started. One of the questions, and it's a real simple one, but I want to make sure that the audience is not confused, because I think it ties a little bit into some of the new corporate laws that are coming down and the tax laws. So I'm going to start a corporation. My choices are CS, LLC. So why would I pick one over the other, and what are those kind of benefits as you see it down the road?
Sure. Well, you know, the United States of America, recently in the last perhaps 35 years, we've had the advent of new corporate form, in the sense of, it's not really that new anymore, but the advent of this limited liability company, the LLC as it's known, that has been an addition to the typical corporation that, you know, that we've had back to the days of American Telephone and Telegraph and National Cash Register and the Standard Oil Company. These were all original early corporations. In the last few decades, this other entity has arisen called the Limited Liability Company. And I would have to say, for the people, particularly the listeners of your show, probably would generally more times than not defer to setting up that method of organization. Just stepping back real quick, the corporation, when we talk about S or C, that's not necessarily the legal form of the corporation. It's still typically a corporation. And the corporation, like the LLC, is formed in the state in which you reside or in the state which with you want to do business.
Okay.
A lot of times you hear about Delaware,
right,
limited liability company. It doesn't necessarily have to be that. It's just the most flexible state to organize one. S or C, that refers to the taxation that the IRS imposes upon the corporation. And generally speaking, you're either a C corporation or you're an S, what they call subchapter C or subchapter S corporation. A small business or a business starting out for reasons of flow through taxation, less tax burdens, is that you would be an S subchapter S corporation, where you're generally taxed not at the corporate level, but all the money that you make in the business flows through to your 1040. You report it as a essentially as income on your 1040 tax return. The LLC is fascinating, and it's really my favorite of the three organizations, okay, because you can have it any way you want. It's not like McDonald's. It's sort of like Burger King. You can have it with all manner of things, and it's very flexible. An LLC could be taxed as really one of the three, you know, the SC corporation. We could have two levels of taxation, and there's reasons why you may want to do that. It could be taxed as an S corporation, and you have all the profits flowing through. And then the more common one is the way that LLC is taxed, or two separate breakouts. One is a single member LLC, like a small business owner that is the sole owner. You could have it as an LLC. It's limited liability. We could talk more about that in a little bit, what the importance of having that is. Or taxation-wise, it's a disregarded entity, means it just flows through. And if you have multiple partners, three, four, five partners, you would form a limited liability company and have it taxed as a partnership. Okay. And then the gains and losses would flow through.
Okay. So really, when somebody's setting this up, that instead of running to LegalZoom, for example, I mean, really looking and seeking counsel to really help understand that it's not just about setting up a corporation. They have to look long-term and the impact of all that as they go forward.
I think it's absolutely essential. I mean, there are people that are reasonably priced that you can use, and you're using their, you know, men and women and their professional expertise. I think LegalZoom is neat in the sense that it's opened up the eyes, if you will, of business entrepreneurs, people starting businesses, to the needs of having those things. And it does prompt a lot. I mean, I've gone through the system. It prompts questions and things like that. It can't think for you. It doesn't have artificial intelligence as much as they say that it would. So there's a lot of reasons why you would want to have certain corporate structures or not. For example, limited liability company, it doesn't have to have an annual meeting of shareholders. You have to have one in a corporation. And that becomes really, really important when you think about why you form a business,
right,
and why you use an entity. Why don't we just do Angelo Ponzi, sole proprietor? The reason why you would want an entity is for limited liability. And that's so that when the business goes out and acts with other people and goes out with it, like such as employees or counterparties or consultants or suppliers or vendors or customers, that if there's liability, something happens with the product that you're, the service that you're providing, or the product that you're selling, or there's some type of a lawsuit, if you respect the corporate form and you do things like have annual meetings in a corporation and you keep your assets separate in the entity, you will have limited liability, meaning that any claims are left at the corporate or entity level and don't inure to you personally.
Okay.
And that's the benefit of forming that.
Okay. So a lot of times, though, I hear this term about piercing the corporate veil. And that tends to be people that are not doing the annual meetings, not filing the paperwork they're supposed to be doing, and frankly, doing things like using their corporate cards to go to the movies and buy groceries and those kinds of things. So can we talk a little bit about the do's and don'ts that the listeners, hopefully nobody's doing that out there.
No.
But if you are, we're going to tell you right now why you shouldn't.
What we could do. Yeah, and it's interesting. Embedded in your question are two of the three critical points with your entity that you want to maintain and respect to prevent against any sort of piercing the corporate veil or trying to, for example, a typical and easy one to explain, you know, your business has a lease, and for whatever reason, you need to break the lease. It could be a lot of different reasons. It doesn't necessarily mean the business is going out of business. But at that point, you have a contract, you could be in breach, there could be a claim, there could be issues. The question is it going to go to Angelo personally, into your personal wallet, or is it going to stop at the entity level? The things you have to respect are threefold. The first two you actually mentioned. The first one is respecting the form of the entity. That's why an LLC in some ways is easier, because a limited liability company doesn't require that you have an annual meeting. You still have to maintain books and records.
Right.
Minutes, same thing like that. Corporation, you have to do those things as well. Using the entity as a personal piggy bank, you mentioned that too in your question.
Yeah, uh-huh.
That's strike two. You don't want to use the company to pay for your personal gardening service or, quite frankly, your personal travel. I mean, as long as you do something as simple as keeping a separate corporate card, it could be a personal credit card. A lot of times I get that question. And the company, the entity, could just reimburse that. But just keep that card separate for business expenses. It doesn't have to be the name of the company. If you respect those things, then you're going forward. And then there's the third and the most important. underfunded, undercapitalized company. You don't want to keep the company so undercapitalized that you're treating it as if it wasn't really an operating entity to begin with. So you want to think about a company that would be well-funded enough. And if you keep those things in order, there is a very low likelihood, practically nil, that in any sort of meltdown or crisis or something or litigation, that the companies would be the what they call piercing the corporate veil, that the actual limited liability of a company would be disregarded. And they'd look at the owners. Generally, it stops there.
So and I think this might be more of an LLC or somebody just operating under a fictitious name. I mean, if you talk about keeping the company well-funded. So if someone's like paying themselves in cash and taking extra cash out of the company and basically bleeding it down, ultimately probably to pay less taxes in the end, I mean, that's kind of the areas where they could get themselves in trouble, right?
It's a very, very, what we call maybe the red zone.
Okay.
The zone of insolvency. You always have to be careful about what they call the zone of insolvency. At that point, we have to really look very closely at what are the obligations of the company. Maybe if you're winding down, that's something you got to think about. And you want to keep enough money in there that would be reflective of an actual operating company. And most businesses and small businesses do this.
Okay. So I was reading one of your blogs the other day, and you talked about closely held family-owned businesses. There are kind of 2 to 3 musts that an attorney should counsel this client on. So one is an independent director to serve on the board or an independent board altogether, a succession plan, and a shareholder agreement or buy-sell agreement. Let's touch on a few of those right now, and I definitely want to talk about the buy-sell agreements. But why don't you hit on those and the importance of them?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, as you think about businesses as they run on their growth arc. This is the Business Growth Cafe. You know, you could have a business that gets to a point where the revenue really starts to thrive, and you're employing more and more people to help you achieve those business goals that you might have. One of the places that businesses, as they go through this growth cycle, turn to, or good advisors tell them as business owners to turn to, is the directors. You know, or an LLC would have managers, but an LLC can have board of directors as well. But generally, governors. In a corporation, the board of directors are supposed to be the governors of the company. And when you start up a business, you might the director may be a husband and wife, or a husband,
sure.
or the business owner and maybe their partner. But as you thrive and as you grow, one of the things you can do, and I love talking to clients about bringing this to the next level, particularly private companies that are not really required to have independent directors. Public companies are under SEC rules. Is to consider bringing on independent directors, someone within the same business field. Often it's someone that might be retired. He or she can come in and talk about how they did all these great things and lend their expertise and their advice. You know, what I like to say is the best independent directors are the people that really don't need to be compensated for whatever compensation you might pay these directors. You might pay them to travel to come to a meeting. You might pay a modest director fee for sitting there. But you don't want someone that's really there to work. You want someone that's there because they love it, because they're in a certain business field or expertise,
right,
where they can really impart upon the business owners their experience having gone through things, good and bad, and help them govern the company. And it's just another view that you would never get if you didn't have someone that was truly independent and not an owner of your company.
Do you find that when it comes to board of directors that they kind of are showing up to the meeting and hearing all the info and making comments, or do you really like the ones that kind of get involved and kind of do homework, if you will, and really participate in all those different activities?
Yeah, without a doubt, you got to have the latter. And you almost arguably wouldn't even want to have independent directors if they're not willing to kind of literally dig in, roll up the sleeves, you know, get the shovel out and start digging in and seeing what they have. And in that vein, you know, what we talk about often is preparation for board meetings. You'd want to have a board meeting, you know, certainly once a year, semi-annual. The one companies that I have, larger private companies that have independent directors on their board with the insider owners, have quarterly board meetings where you go over the previous quarter and then you compare your performance year over year, and also look at things like, you know, 3 to 5 year plans going forward and cash flows and things like that. You got to prepare for them.
Right.
So these companies generally prepare presentations, materials, and they, you know, rule of thumb, if you can get it out 10 to 14 days before your meeting, your director will be, well served by going through all that.
So I'm actually sit on a board And we have quarterly meetings. Actually, you're working on the 3 to 5 year plan that the board is going to get at the end of this month for a meeting. I think it's on the 5th. So we're following those rules, really trying to push hard to make sure the plans are in place and really dig in. And I can see how what you're saying about a board and the board that we have in place for this privately held company is 30 years old. And they brought in outside advisors a year ago to help them really look to the future and do the growth. So that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about shareholder agreements and buy-sell. Now, I've had the opportunity to own and build and sell a company. I've also had partners at various stages in life. And, you know, partners always make it really interesting. And so how can we avoid some of those issues, you know, when someone decides to sell their business or really starts thinking about it at the very beginning?
Yeah, it's a great question. It comes up very often in my practice. And sometimes, unfortunately, it comes up too late when you have business disputes. You have a business with multiple partners, say three or four partners, so to say, or owners, and they are at each other's throats on certain issues about the direction in which they're going to take the business, mm-hmm. Or moving into certain growth opportunities or not. And that is when you want to make sure or look back and say, gee, do we have anything that talks about what happens when we get into perhaps disputes with each other? What happens when one of us wants to, or two of us want to sell the business or sell our ownership? What happens if someone becomes disabled or, God forbid, passes away?
Right.
And these are those exact types of things that, you know, you've mentioned that where a buy-sell agreement comes into place, also called a shareholder agreement. And there is no better time to put one of these things in place is when you're actually forming the business or early on in the business's life cycle. And what they generally do, or the most important aspects of this agreement, is it's a legal agreement that says, as between Angelo and Mike, what is going to happen when Angelo gets disabled and something happens to him, God forbid. Is there going to be a mechanism by which Mike will carry on with the business? Or similarly, if one of us wants to sell, or if you have multiple partners and there's a group, perhaps maybe a majority of the ownership of the company, 51%+, want to sell the business, what happens to the little shareholder, the 5% shareholder that maybe doesn't want to sell? It answers these questions up
right.
front.
Well, a quick story. This is years ago. A guy I knew, one of my clients, it was two of them. They acquired their largest distributor, now, and they gave them stock. Now there was four.
Right.
And those two distributors wanted to go public. The other two did not. They convinced one of the partners to go public. The original founder of the company said, absolutely not, and they pushed him out of his company.
Right.
Yeah, so that was early on in my career that I thought, okay, these things become really important because they probably didn't take the time to figure out what was going to happen in a dispute.
I'm glad you mentioned it, too, because it just points up to the fact that it's real. I mean, this kind of stuff really happens all day long in America in business, small, medium size, and, you know, dare I say, large business. You have to get these issues worked out up front, and a good counselor can help you do that.
So we've probably got, believe it or not, probably like 3 or 4 minutes left. So give or take. My engineer is over there waving fingers at me, so I haven't quite figured out the cryptic. So let's talk about, and I talked about acquisition in the beginning.
Yeah.
So that's one of the ways that businesses can grow. So I saw you speak the other day, and you talked about kind of the common factors of a sale. Negotiating and signing the letter of intent, due diligence process, definitive agreement, approvals obtained, board of directors, shareholders, third-party approvals, and the closing, which you also had a party, but I didn't include that in this comment.
Can't forget the party.
So the other thing you said is whether it's a small business or a large business, this is kind of the form, the steps that you always go through.
That's right.
Why don't we talk about this for a few minutes? And talk about how businesses prepare. Really, and what's that kind of time frame?
Sure.
I said I sold my business. I literally, all of a sudden, we got letters, and they were pushing, and this thing happened in like less than 60 days. We were not prepared at all for the sale. And so we certainly didn't do 90% of probably what's sitting on your sheet here.
Well, but, you know, it's interesting. You know, as we said the other day, too, at the our presentation that, you know, much like some of these things we talked about, the best time to get organized for the sale of your business is when you may have no interest in selling your business whatsoever, and you may not want to sell your business at all. But it's a great opportunity to get things, you know, sort of say your ducks in a row. And there's a couple of things you can do. And it's like you said, whether you are a business that is selling that's $5 million or $50 million or $500 million, generally speaking, it's going to run down the same track, same process. And a lot of that runs around what's called due diligence. When someone is looking to buy your business or enter some kind of strategic partnership with you, it doesn't necessarily be an acquisition, but someone that could really take your business to the next level or create a liquidity event for you is going to look at doing very significant what's called due diligence. And that is just a fancy term for research, digging in on the facts, checking things, auditing things, and making sure that what you say your business is really is. And there's a lot of preparation that you can do around that. And while you're doing that, you know, it's about getting your own corporate ducks in order. And one of the examples we talked about was the idea that you may have a major customer or a major supplier for your business. Mm-hmm. And you have a very important agreement with that counterparty, but it's not in writing. It's a good friend, or it's someone you've worked with for 16 years, and it's on a handshake. Those are the kind of things you need to sort of document, because no one will really create value and place value on these types of things, that the kind of value that you want, unless you have everything kind of documented correctly. And these are the kind of things that go into due diligence.
Okay. I want to sneak in one other question before we come to our kind of closing questions. Insurance, business insurance, errors and omission, D&O, commercial general liability, and now cyber.
Yeah, sure.
So talk about, I mean, I think all these other business owners, I hope you're aware of, but cyber insurance is kind of, I'm going to say, new on the market.
Yeah, and it happens all the time. I had a client, I could tell you very quickly, that we had a situation where an email went that was spoofed from the CEO to a mid-level marketing director, asking the mid-level marketing director to go to the Apple store and buy hundreds of Apple gift cards. And the marketing director said, oh gosh, this is a direct, you know, email from the CEO, I better go out and do it. And he went out and did it. And he came back and he said, I have all the cards. And the alleged CEO said, okay, great, turn them over, scratch them off, and take pictures of them and send them to me. Now, putting aside the fact the marketing director was a little bit foolish.
Cyber, I think they need my services, by the way.
This is where we need you. This is the importance of the Business Growth Cafe, Angelo. But for this reason, we need things like insurance, because it can protect against acts. And that clearly was a cyber attack, so to say, where the email of the CEO was mimicked to the point that it basically sounded like him giving someone directions to, you know, commit financial fraud. But I can't speak highly enough about the importance of having business insurance, general comprehensive liability, E&O, employment, EPL, employment practices liability, and cyber, because the first thing I do as general counsel is when we get something, event happens, or particularly a lawsuit, is you want to see, you want to scour your insurance policies, because more times than not, you can find coverage in there. And that means getting your legal fees paid for and any settlement that you may have to pay as a result of any problem.
So two more questions. 3 to 5 tips you want to give the listeners, some of the things, all the things we talked about today. What are those 3 or 4 or 5 things that they should absolutely do?
Sure. I would say probably first and foremost is I have to make a plug for our profession. You want to make sure that no matter what, when you're either in that growth mode or you're in that starting mode, that you want to get good advice. There's no, you really can't put a number on the importance and value of getting good advice up front to get things structured correctly. Now, going to LegalZoom is better than doing nothing at all, no question about it. But as you know, being at some of these presentations, you hear things like, gee, I was going to try to sell my business by myself, or just go to a couple of events and look online. You know, the internet is a wonderful, amazing thing. It does great things like this program that we're enjoying that I've had the honor to be on. But at the same time, it creates all this information flow where people think they can do things that maybe they shouldn't.
Okay.
Getting great advice is one of those things.
All right, I'm getting some signals over here. So one last question. We're both small business owners. What keeps you up at night when you think about your business?
What keeps me up at night? Probably being up to speed on the latest developments in our practice, because we're moving so fast. It's important to make sure that I'm up to speed so that my clients are up to speed.
Okay. So thank you so much. This has been a great discussion. I think we're going to have to do this again next year, which is not too far away. So why don't you tell the audience how they can reach you and all the different ways that they might contact you?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Well, yeah, my website is just corpgencounsel.com. So it's corpgencounsel.com. And it has a lot of information about the practice. And if you are in need of any help, and we can certainly help you. And if not, we can point you to the right place.
Okay. And you're on LinkedIn as well. And
LinkedIn,
all that
and
good stuff.
All that other social media. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And I know the audience is going to as well. So thank you again for joining us at the cafe. You can find out more about me and read my blogs at the Ponzi Group. That's theponzigroup.com. You got that. And connect with me on LinkedIn as well. And you can subscribe to the show on businessgrowthcafe.com, or we are now on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, and Stitcher, and coming soon to Streaker, SoundCloud, iHeartRadio, and many others around the world. Join me again next week for lunch at the Business Growth Cafe.
Thank you for listening to today's discussion at the Business Growth Cafe with your host, Angelo Ponzi. Take a moment to subscribe to this podcast and visit our website at www.businessgrowthcafe.com. Read Angelo Ponzi's blogs at www.theponzigroup.com.